From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! What was Congressmember Henry Hyde's involvement in the collapse of an Illinois savings and loan? And what happened to the independent bank investigator who tried to expose him? Also, we'll speak with leading women's rights advocates about the murder of Dr. Barnett Slepian, a man who performed abortions in a Buffalo women's health clinic. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, looks set to survive a no-confidence vote in the Knesset today after signing an interim peace accord with the Palestinians in the U.S., despite opposition from many supporters of his right-wing government. Netanyahu is depending on the opposition Labor Party, which has promised a safety net in parliament to save the interim accords and keep the government intact. Several members of Netanyahu's shaky coalition are expected to vote against the government. Under last week's deal, Israel will hand over 13% of the West Bank to the Palestinians in return for increased security cooperation. The agency will also have a crucial part in exchanging intelligence between Israelis and Palestinians and coordinating strategy on preempting terrorist attacks. That's the CIA. Meanwhile, Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Richard Shelby says he wants to hold hearings on the CIA's involvement in the Mideast land for security deal. The Alabama Republican told Fox News Sunday that he's bothered by the agreement's provision that the CIA would play a visible role. Under the U.S. broker deal between Israel and the Palestinians, the CIA would keep track of Palestinian efforts to arrest and punish terrorists. The deal would create a three-party mediation system in which Palestinian and Israeli security officials could present disputes to a CIA arbiter. Women's health advocates said this weekend the name of a New York doctor targeted by abortion protesters and slain this weekend was on an anti-abortion website list of abortion providers and crossed out soon after his death. Police reported no developments in their hunt for the sniper who shot Dr. Barnett Slepian with a single shot through the kitchen window of his home near Buffalo, New York, on Friday night. More on this in the last segment of today's program. This news from London. Augusto Pinochet's lawyers argued today that the former Chilean dictator's arrest on a Spanish warrant was illegal because ex-rulers have immunity from prosecution for acts committed in a, quote, official capacity. As Pinochet's lawyers presented their case, a Chilean military aircraft with medical personnel and equipment was on standby at a Royal Air Force base northwest of London to take the former dictator home if he wins the case. The hearing, which began today, was expected to last until tomorrow. Civil rights activist and former Democratic presidential hopeful Reverend Jesse Jackson said yesterday he's considering another run for the White House in the year 2000, saying on NBC's Meet the Press, quote, "I'm leaning in that direction." Jackson, who founded the civil rights organizations Rainbow Coalition and Operation Push, said a black Democrat should be on the ballot in 2000. This news from Colombia. A right-wing death squad killed 8 people and at least 15 others were feared dead in a pre-dawn raid on a municipality in northwest Colombia yesterday. This according to the Colombian police. According to a report published by Human Rights Watch this month, right-wing death squads, often operating with the open or tacit support of the military, are responsible for 60% of the most serious rights violations in Colombia. France this weekend blasted a U.S. proposal for Gulf Arab states to join Washington in developing and deploying a missile shield system in the region, saying it could speed up an existing arms race. Earlier this month, U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen made the proposal during a tour of the 6 Gulf Arab states, which are suffering from an oil price slump. Baghdad yesterday attacked the U.N. commission set up to dismantle Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, accusing it of espionage and demanding a U.N. investigation into its activities. This news from Havana. Cuba's President Fidel Castro told a group of U.S. newspaper editors this weekend he felt U.S. news reporting on Cuba was often biased, and he vowed no surrender to U.S. aggression. From Tehran, Iran has branded U.S.-funded Farsi-language broadcasts being beamed into the country as interference and warned the Czech Republic about hosting the new station. Western media have in the past reported that the United States has set up a $20 million fund for covert action against Iran. And according to one of his advisors, former South African President F.W. de Klerk is to seek a court order blocking the country's Truth Commission from publishing claims linking him to apartheid-era violence. And finally, Bill Clinton wrapped up a two-day campaign trip to California, during which he raised $2.1 million for fellow Democrats, including Senator Barbara Boxer. He was saluted by Hollywood stars and avoided any mention of the White House sex scandal. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
You can't hide, Henry Hyde. You can't run. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, from what you've done. Took a wife from a man, a mother from her kids. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, because we all know what you did. You can't hide, Henry Hyde. You can't run. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, from what you've done. And now you sit in judgment of Bill the President. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, partisan hypocrite.
That's from Beatniks from Mars. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, but we're not going to be talking about Henry Hyde's love affair today. We're going to take a look at what the chair of the House Judiciary Committee's involvement in the collapse of an Illinois savings and loan, and what happened to the independent bank investigator who tried to expose him. We're joined by that bank investigator right now, Tim Anderson, joining us from Illinois. We're also joined by Dennis Bernstein. Dennis is the host of a Pacifica radio station KPFA daily program called Flashpoints, and he has been investigating this and exposing the story, a story which today interviews Dennis has done and also tells the story of Tim Anderson in the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having us, Amy.
Thanks, Amy. Good morning.
Good morning. Dennis, start off by telling us how you got interested in this and how you met Tim Anderson.
Well, back in the early part of this decade, I was investigating the SNLs. People might remember Pacifica Radio covered the Keating Five hearings in Washington. That was when five senators, including the one that's now getting ready to go to space, were investigated for taking major amounts of campaign contributions from banker Charles Keating. Well, it was a mess. The SNLs ultimately went down for... The Wall Street Journal said at one point it would cost U.S. taxpayers $1.3 trillion. And apparently one of the key players in that was Henry Hyde, who as a board member sat on the Clyde, it's Hyde and Clyde here, the Clyde SNL in Illinois, and that went down for $70 million, about.
Well, Tim Anderson, you're an independent bank investigator. And first, what exactly does that mean? And talk a little about what you found.
Well, actually, I spent many, many years as a bank consultant in operations, and only when I found my hometown savings and loan of Libertyville Federal becoming insolvent, I started to network with people that I had moved along in their careers and became sort of the number one thrift investigator in Illinois. I was incensed that my state was the number two state for the most failed charters and the number three state for the greatest cost. There was no reason, because Illinois was primarily a mutual state, and should have never gotten involved in out-of-state lending in the first place. So I devoted time from 1988 currently to trying to figure out why Illinois was so significant. It was halfway through my investigation that I tripped over Congressman Henry Hyde, Cabinet Member Ed Madigan, and Cabinet Member Ed Derwinski, who are key to the entire Illinois savings and loan scandal, which really controls the national savings and loan scandal.
Explain what Henry Hyde's involvement was in that scandal.
Henry Hyde was on the House Banking Committee up until June of 81. In December of 81, he went on the board of Clyde Federal Savings and Loan, which was becoming extremely insolvent at that point. He knew it was insolvent when he went on. But in 82, 83, and 84, Congress passed legislation to weaken the savings and loans and let the weaker ones get into greater trouble. So in effect, you had a paid director of a savings and loan on the floor of the House, even though Henry said he didn't vote on that legislation, he voted present. He was able to speak to his fellow congressman, give his views as a senior Republican congressman of how he felt in the up-and-coming legislation. You had the ultimate lobbyist on the floor of the House. Charles Keating, with five senators, couldn't accomplish for a second what Henry was able to accomplish by being a lobbyist while in Congress simultaneously.
Now, Tim, Henry Hines says that,
Dennis Bernstein.
He was on this board, but he was out of the loop. What indication do you have that Congressman Hyde was in the loop and participating in some of these horrific loan practices?
Through an extensive effort of getting FOIA requests, we were able to receive minutes of the board meeting where Henry was making all of the motions that helped sink the savings and loan. One of Henry's fellow directors, who was quoted in today's roll call story, told me when I contacted him that when Henry made or seconded a motion, there was never a discussion. It was immediately passed. All board members looked to Henry for the leadership because of his knowledge as not only a lawyer and a future head of judiciary, but as a former member of House Banking. The minutes of the board meeting show it was Henry who continuously wanted them to buy securities from Swink & Company of Little Rock, Arkansas. That's the first part that crossed the star's path. It was Henry that seconded a motion that they buy CDs from a Grand Cayman branch. Any congressman should have jumped up and ran out of the room and off the board instantly when they had a sleepy little mutual in Illinois buying CDs from a Grand Cayman branch. It was Henry that put them in their first out-of-state loan in Texas, with an Arkansas thrift being the lead lender. It was Henry who made the motion after Ed Gray had gone through the House and the Senate and said Texas is a sinkhole. It was Henry who got them to invest millions of dollars in a Dallas office project that could not go forward, and Henry should have known as a congressman listening to Ed Gray that Texas was a sinkhole. Henry was the ringleader. He was the board leader. He was the board member who was controlling management. Henry was the man involved.
Now, that SNL was in fact sued for negligence, gross negligence, mismanagement, breach of fiduciary and other duties, breach of contract, and other wrongful and improper conduct. The initial suit against Hyde and the others was $17 million. How long did it take to finally get to some settlement, and what did Hyde ultimately have to pay for that $17 million lawsuit?
Henry paid nothing. Henry was able to tie it up in court for over 3 years on a motion to be dismissed. And while that motion to be dismissed was taking 3 years, which should have taken only 90 days, to delay the case, Henry was able to stay discovery. So for 3 years, the RTC could take no depositions and go no further in their investigation after they brought the suit. The judge ruled, Judge Brian Duff, a Republican-appointed federal judge, ruled that there was every likelihood the plaintiffs would prevail, meaning the RTC would prevail, let there be a trial. The appellate court upheld that decision. And in July of 1996, Henry Hyde, in open court, was assigned a trial date. So as head of the judiciary, the man had a trial date. The FDIC, which inherited the case from the RTC, then decided, because it was Henry, they would settle the case for what their legal bills were, less than 5%. By the way, that is unique. The RTC never has settled, or the FDIC, a case for less than 5% of the money asked for after they won in the appellate court and had a trial date set. Henry's special deal was if the other directors would pay the $850,000, he would have to pay nothing. But the FDIC made it very clear that Henry would not be released with the other directors until Henry saw that the $850,000 was in from the other directors. So the other directors had to pay Henry's fair share in order for him to pay nothing. And then to add injury to insult, Henry was able to get the number one law firm doing the most business with the FDIC to hold a fundraiser to pay all of Henry's legal bills, while his fellow defendants had to pay his fair share plus their own legal bills.
You're listening to Tim Anderson, who's an independent bank investigator consultant, and put out the report this year, regulatory and political favoritism that caused Illinois to suffer the second largest number of savings and loan failures, a report I'm quite sure Congressmember Henry Hyde doesn't want you to see. We're also joined by Pacifica Station KPFA producer Dennis Bernstein, who has been investigating the collapse of the banking system in this country and particularly been looking at this latest issue and his interview with the investigator who investigated Tim Anderson. We're going to play in just a minute. In fact, Tim Anderson, can you explain what happened to you as you doggedly pursued Henry Hyde's involvement in the collapse of the Clyde Savings and Loan?
Well, I continuously went to the media to ask them to investigate because they had greater resources than I did. But the media kept suggesting that Henry is not important, Henry's not prominent, that Henry was an old story and anybody could be sued. So they just refused to investigate Illinois. And I talked to every major media person in the country, as they've all known over a period of years. But finally, I got a call from an individual that identified himself as Ray, and I really can't remember his last name. We know his real name in a few minutes. But Ray asked if I would meet with him, that he was an independent producer that wanted to know more about this Henry Hyde issue because I was showing up in Crane Chicago Business and other various papers and just little clips here and there. Molly Ivins did a syndicated column on me. Actually, she did two columns on the issue. So Ray met with me at a restaurant and told me he was an independent producer. And I gave him about 400 pages of documentation, a couple of videotapes of some TV shows I'd been on this issue. And finally, after 3.5 weeks of giving him calls on his cell phone, I finally said, Ray, if you're not going to get anything done, just give it back. Let me send it on to someone who can figure it out. But in one of the calls, a voice answered a voice message and said, this is Ernie Rizzo. And I recognized the voice of Ray, the person I'd been talking with. So when I contacted him, I said, Ray, are you Ernie Rizzo or are you Ray? He said, well, Ernie Rizzo's an alias I go under because for my investigation work. What I didn't know, which I found out a couple weeks ago, that Ernie Rizzo was really a private detective, a rather prominent private detective, hired by Henry to investigate me, just a member of the public. I was never a party to the case. And I got investigated and spied on by a prominent private detective because I got involved and asked questions as citizens should.
Now, this is a key point. How do you know that Ernie Rizzo, who is a well-known private investigator in Chicago, how do you know he was hired by the Congressman Henry Hyde?
Actually, that's in today's roll call and was in a week earlier in the Chicago Tribune's D.C. Metro section. Ernie's biggest problem is he just likes to talk, and if reporters will charm him long enough, he will just say it all. Even though he keeps saying up front, for confidential reasons, he shouldn't. But for some reason, Ernie just can't keep his mouth shut if reporters will spend some time with him. And he is now talking to reporters all over the area, and it's really extensive in this morning's roll call newspaper.
Dennis Bernstein, you did have a chance to talk to Ernie Rizzo before he has refused to speak. I actually gave him a call on Friday. He called back and he said, I can't talk about this investigation unless I am released to do so by my client. And he had not gotten a release from him. But you did have a chance to talk to him.
Yes, as soon as there was the slight mention in the Chicago Tribune, I tried to go after him, called him. He actually called me back, and he seemed anxious to talk. So we took him into the recording studio via telephone, and we asked him several different ways the question about who hired him. At one point, I, you know, as people will hear, asked him if he could, in fact, deny for a fact that he did not and was not paid by Henry Hyde, and he could not deny that. And I think anybody who hears him and reads the transcript will see him confirming the man was doing work for Henry Hyde, and he was apparently trying to undermine, intimidate, and find out more about what Tim Anderson was doing.
And Tim Anderson, in today's roll call, they interview ethics experts about the ethics of him being hired to investigate you and pose as a reporter, which may not be illegal, but may end up, if in fact Henry Hyde hired him, may be considered an illegal gift, the investigation. Is that right?
Well, not only that, I've illustrated continuously that Henry, in his financial disclosure statements, never declared the free legal service he got for 3.5 years from his lawyers. He never declared it as a debt to his attorneys or a gift from his attorneys. Henry has continuously stated, I have permission from the Ethics Department to not pay any money. I have permission from the Ethics Department to refer my legal bills. So as I said in my paper, it moves the point. Does Henry just get signed stationery from the Ethics Department, and he just types in what he needs? It really needs to be investigated.
And it's important to understand that this is a wide-ranging two-month investigation in which Tim Anderson's neighbors and friends were investigated, talked to secretly. Ernie Rizzo would not confirm what he was paid, but apparently it was $10,000. So this could be a $10,000 illegal gift that Henry Hyde never claimed on his taxes.
Well, we're going to go back to this in just a minute. We're going to stop for stations to identify themselves. Our guests, independent bank consultant Timothy Anderson. His report, called Regulatory and Political Favoritism That Caused Illinois to Suffer the Second Largest Number of Savings and Loan Failures. Also with us, Dennis Bernstein, Pacifica producer at KPFA in Berkeley, California. His program is a daily investigative report called Flashpoints. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by them, as well as Dennis's interview with Ernie Rizzo. Stay with us.
You can't hide, Henry Hyde, you can't run. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, from what you've done. Took a wife from a man, a mother from her kids. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, 'cause we all know what you did. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, you can't run. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, from what you've done. And now you sit in judgment of Bill the President. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, partisan hypocrite.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we talk to independent bank investigator Tim Anderson and Pacifica Station KPFA producer Dennis Bernstein about the failed savings and loan in Illinois that led to an investigation of the bank investigator who was looking into it. Today's roll call starts off by saying Tim Anderson believed the mountain of documents he turned over to a TV producer in 1995 was just one more attempt to interest a reporter in the story of House Judiciary Chair Henry Hyde's involvement in the $67 million collapse of a Chicago area savings and loan. But the producer was really a private eye hired to spy on Anderson and find out what information he had on the Illinois Republican. Ernie Rizzo, the private investigator, said in an interview he did the job for Hyde and his lawyer and was paid with a cashier's check in the mail. Hyde acknowledged to the Chicago Tribune he was aware of the operation and was informed of the results, but that he did not pay for or authorize the deceptive detective work. The revelation of the scan, confirmed by all of the parties involved, threatens to revive old questions about the handling of Hyde's litigation over the failed thrift and may pose new problems, including whether the investigative service violated ethical standards or house gift rules. We're going to turn now to Dennis Bernstein's interview with Ernie Rizzo that he did just a few weeks ago. Again, Ernie Rizzo, the well-known Chicago private investigator who Chicago Magazine profiled and called a glitterati gumshoe whose 36-year career has spanned such celebrated cases as the O.J. Simpson murder trial, child abuse accusations against Michael Jackson, and the disappearance of candy heiress Helen Brock. And we're going to turn to Dennis Bernstein's interview with him right now.
Ernie Rizzo, and it's my agency. I'm a licensed private detective here in Chicago.
You were involved in an investigation of a Timothy Anderson. He considers himself an independent bank investigator. What motivated that investigation?
Well, I was called by a client to make an investigation into Mr. Anderson. Apparently, he was following a particular lawsuit, federal lawsuit, a little too close, and some of the parties involved in the lawsuit want to know what his interest was.
Now, this is the lawsuit having to do with the I guess, the suing of Clyde Savings and Loan there in Illinois?
Yes, the $87 million loss of savings and loans.
Yeah, I think it was, it went down for about $70 million, and there was I believe it was an $850,000 lawsuit against the members of the board of that SNL.
That's right.
And among the members of the board was the now head of the Judiciary Committee, Henry Hyde, correct?
That's correct.
Now, can you tell us who it was that asked you to investigate, Mr. Anderson?
No, I really can't. There is some confidentiality laws here in Chicago, and really without that person's permission, I'd be opening myself up for libel.
Can you tell me for a fact that it was not Chairman Hyde?
No, I cannot tell you that.
Okay, so you can't say for a fact that it was not Henry Hyde?
No, I really can't confirm or deny who the client was in that investigation. I mean, again, I'm bound by state laws here.
Can I ask you what you were asked to investigate?
Mr. Anderson, who he was and what his position was and what kind of information. He apparently had been disseminating information, and my client wanted to know exactly what his position was in this case.
And did Mr. Anderson openly and willingly participate and work with you, answer your questions?
Well, you know, again, I've been an investigator for 30-some years, and certain people take certain techniques. I didn't identify myself to Mr. Anderson, but I use a technique that's used by law enforcement and FBI agents for years. It's just certain techniques work better on certain people.
And what exactly was the technique that you employed in this case?
Well, Mr. Anderson apparently liked to talk to reporters, and I purported to be a reporter, and he spoke to me fluently.
Uh-huh. So you purported to be a reporter, and were you asking him questions about his investigation into this failed SNL that was that had on its board Henry Hyde?
Yes, I did.
Uh-huh. What was motivating your client? What was your client's fear? Why did he want a private investigator to investigate Mr. Anderson?
Well, no one knew who Anderson was and why he kept appearing in court and why he kept appearing in the judge's chambers, and he wanted to see the savings and loan thing resolve, and apparently my client wanted to know what his position was, who he was, and what he was doing in this case.
And what did you ascertain?
Well, he apparently had some sort of dealings with Clyde Federal Savings and Loan, and he felt that he did not want Mr. Hyde and his directors to go unpunished for what he believed was the failing of the savings and loan by Hyde.
So you might characterize him as an independent citizen and with some knowledge of banking, who was concerned as a citizen about what had happened and what might have gone wrong at this particular sort of sleepy SNL.
Right. So he apparently has some knowledge and apparently was blaming Hyde and the directors for the savings and loan failure. And we wanted to see what he was talking about.
And so your investigation found that essentially Mr. Anderson was who he said he was, which was this independent expert on banking that was trying to hold this particular group of directors accountable.
That's right.
And where did you make your results available? Henry Hyde admits, is in terms of the story that appeared in the Chicago Tribune on Sunday, he admits that he received the results of your investigation.
Well, I made a report. I turned in a report with some documents.
And how did this report get disseminated?
I don't know.
Did you make it available to all the members, including Mr. Hyde?
No, I made it available just to one person.
you made it available to one person, but you can't say for you cannot say based on confidentiality whether that person was the person who hired you. That person was Henry Hyde.
I cannot say that. No.
How did Henry Hyde get a copy of the report if you only gave it to one person?
Well, I mean, I guess you'll have to ask Henry Hyde.
All right. And how much time, can I ask you how much you were paid for this investigation?
I don't really know how I can comment on that. It was a two-month investigation.
It was a two-month investigation, and did you call other people besides Mr. Anderson to find out if he was credible and if he was who he said he was?
We made a total and complete investigation, Mr. Anderson.
So did you just to give us a sense of the breadth of that investigation, did you call 6 other people, 20 other people? Did you call his friends, his neighbors, his...
Quite a few people.
Uh-huh. Did they include people within his sort of realm of existence, people he worked with, people who were friends with him?
Well, it would be the standard people you'd usually talk to when you're doing some background on an investigation. Working people, and neighbors, and business associates, things like that.
And what did they tell you about Mr. Anderson?
Well, again, he apparently had a desperate need to see that the directors of Clyde Savings and Loan were punished, and he wasn't going to let go until they were punished.
In your investigation, were you able to confirm certain aspects of the claims that Mr. Anderson was making? He said at one point that while the board was sued for $850,000, Henry Hyde himself paid nothing.
I believe that was correct.
Mm-hmm. And did you find anything in terms of what Mr. Anderson was saying that seemed to be made up, false, a bold-faced lie, misleading?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm.
Not really.
I see. And he says that he provided material to you, an extensive amount, a 388-page report to you, I believe he said, and that you gave it back to him in a cheap briefcase. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know if I gave it back to him in a cheap briefcase or what he gave it to me in, but I gave him back. It was quite a few documents, and I did put it in some sort of carrier instead of dropping the pages all over.
And did you share these documents with anybody besides your client? In terms of the documentation, who examined the documentation that you collected?
My client.
Mm-hmm. And is your client based in Illinois?
Yes, he is.
Uh-huh. And was your client one of the members of the banking board?
We can dance with this all day, but I cannot tell you who the client was.
And of course, you understand the significance in this case. If Henry Hyde himself hired a private investigator to go and investigate an independent citizen, the citizen can construe this as intimidation.
Well, I don't know. Investigations are conducted all day long by private investigators. I don't know if Hyde has any protection under the law one way or the other, nor does a citizen. I don't know. I don't know if Hyde was being sued in his capacity of a politician or in his capacity as a private individual who was a director of a bank.
Uh-huh. And just finally, you said that you received many, your phone was ringing quite frequently from people who were interested, members of the press. Which, did any major press institutions get in touch with you to find out more about this?
Most of them.
Most of them?
Most of them, yeah.
So that would include AP, ABC, what?
Well, most of the networks and Washington newspapers.
Uh-huh. And I guess you didn't reveal this to anybody, huh?
Haven't told anything more than I've told you. And again, I'm limited, and I really can't. And I really can't. You know, it's not a matter of my personal. It's a matter of state law here. I don't know what the laws are like in California, but here, without the written consent of your client, it puts you in a bad spot.
So if your client chose to, they could give you permission to reveal all of this to the public.
No question. If the client said, go ahead and tell them what they want to know, then I'd be free to tell you anything you want to know.
All right. Did your client suggest that this man could, that Mr. Anderson could be dangerous, a stalker, and
I really can't get into that with you.
Okay. All right. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us, Mr. Rizzo.
Sure.
And thanks for calling us back.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been listening to Ernie Rizzo, the private investigator, interviewed by Pacifica producer Dennis Bernstein. Ernie Rizzo said in an interview, actually, with the Chicago Tribune, he did the job for Henry Hyde and his lawyer and was paid with a cashier's check in the mail, that job to investigate Tim Anderson. Tim Anderson, the independent bank consultant who has been following Henry Hyde's career and his involvement in the failed Clyde Savings and Loan, and put out a report this year called Regulatory and Political Favoritism that caused Illinois to suffer the second largest number of savings and loan failures. We're joined by Tim Anderson on the phone, as well as Dennis Bernstein. Tim, how did it feel to be investigated as a private citizen, and who did they speak to exactly?
I don't know. None of my neighbors have come forward, and none of the people I work with, but I've been out of the banking industry for about 6 years now, so I'm not sure who Ernie spoke to. I'm glad he determined that I was an honest, ethical person just trying to investigate. I'm glad he finally gave me a clean bill of health. I'm a little bit shocked that since I was not a party to the case, but someone who sat, in the courtroom to listen to the case, would be investigated. By the way, I never had any dealings with Clyde. Clyde was just one of many Illinois savings and loans that I was following, all the savings and loans. And one other thing which no one's ever asked and I've sort of never mentioned, except in a few other newspaper stories, as a bank consultant, I don't receive any compensation. I have no clients. I've spent the last 8 years doing this and going broke just because I believe it's something that needs to be done. So where Ernie gets paid up to $10,000 to investigate me, I take whatever I make from an hourly job and invest it in the phone bill to try to investigate, and probably my biggest expense is going out to Office Max to photocopy stuff that I send out to people.
We only have a few minutes, but Dennis Bernstein, I was wondering if you can put this story in the larger context and also in the scandal that we're looking at today in Washington. Here is Hyde investigating President Clinton for a sex scandal based on a report that Kenneth Starr put forward when he was initially appointed to investigate the Whitewater scandal.
Well, this is interesting. Tim says he had very limited resources to investigate this SNL problem in Illinois, and he found big, very important material that got him investigated. Well, here you have Ken Starr spending $40 million in what has started out to be an SNL investigation, and he comes up with only sex. It's very interesting to note that Ken Starr's investigation of SNLs should have brought right up on his radar screen the investments that Henry Hyde's Clyde was making in Arkansas. What I'm saying here is if Ken Starr was really doing an SNL investigation, he might be going after Henry Hyde and not after Bill Clinton. The bottom line, the SNL failure moved perhaps more money in the history of this country from poor to rich. This bailout cost mothers and children milk money. This bailout cost San Francisco a lack of money to rebuild after the earthquake. So here you have a situation where we have an SNL investigation that only comes up with Monica Lewinsky. Tim Anderson, who is a citizen concerned about what happened in Illinois and what's going on with SNLs, he ends up essentially being blackballed from the industry because he told the truth.
And we're talking about overall an SNL scandal to the tune of $1.3 trillion that taxpayers bailed out?
That's correct. According to the Wall Street Journal, it is $1.3 trillion. We will never know exactly what that price is. What we do know is that Henry Hyde played a major role in costing this country billions and billions of dollars, partially to cover up his own apparent illegal activities.
And so finally, Tim Anderson, when you see Henry Hyde investigating President Clinton over a sex scandal, what are your thoughts today?
Well, I'm actually more angry at Gephardt and John Dingell and L.C. Hastings and all the other Democrats who have known this story for the last over 2 years now. I was in Washington in the last week of March of 95, visiting with L.C. Hastings' office, giving them the material, Joe Kennedy's office, Barney Frank's office. I met with Gephardt in May of 96. He gave me the names of his three general counsels to talk with. The DCCC, since February of 96, has had all the material. It's the Democrats who have cut a deal with Henry, that Henry, no matter what you did, it will never be discussed. We will protect, and that's why I say in my paper, I call it the Braveheart Syndrome, where Gephardt plays the role of Lord Bruce, protecting himself, thereby denying his contributors and voters the rights they need to know.
Well, Tim Anderson and Dennis Bernstein, I want to thank you very much for this expose on Democracy Now! Timothy Anderson is an independent bank consultant, wrote the report this year, Regulatory and Political Favoritism That Caused Illinois to Suffer the Second Largest Number of Savings and Loan Failures. And Dennis Bernstein, thank you for your dogged investigation. Dennis Bernstein of Pacifica Station, KPFA, and host of Flashpoints. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
You can't hide, Henry Hyde. You can't run. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, from what you've done. Took a wife from a man, a mother from her kids. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, because we all know what you did. You can't hide, Henry Hyde. You can't run. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, from what you've done. And now you sit in judgment of Bill the President. You can't hide, Henry Hyde, partisan hypocrite.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The name of a New York doctor targeted by abortion protesters and slain this weekend was on an anti-abortion website list of abortion providers and crossed out soon after his death. This according to abortion rights advocates. Police yesterday reported no developments in their hunt for the sniper who shot Dr. Barnett Slepian. He was 51 years old with a single shot through the kitchen window of his home near Buffalo, New York on Friday night. Slepian's name and address were among those of doctors who perform abortions and, quote, their accomplices on the website www.christiangallery.com/atrocity/aborts.html. A Planned Parenthood official said a line appeared through Slepian's name early Saturday. On Sunday, Slepian was among dozens of names listed on the site underneath a graphic of dripping blood and a heading. Said a line through a name represented a fatality. We're joined right now by two women who've long been active in the struggle for abortion rights. Vicki Breitbart is on the board of the National Abortion Federation, and Gloria Felt is the president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. They both held a news conference on Saturday. Gloria Felt, what did you say?
On Saturday, we had to first just talk about the very sad and distressing facts of the case. We wanted to express our condolences to the family, and we wanted to highlight what this is really about, that there is, in fact, an organized effort to basically strike a blow to the heart of democracy by violence and harassment and even murder of those of us who provide abortion services. And that it's important for the public to understand this, and it is important for law enforcement to take very seriously the job that is their responsibility, in fact, to protect these people and to do the appropriate surveillance and prevention efforts. But most importantly, to protect physicians and others who are providing women with very much needed health care services, who are doing what they morally believe in as well. And this is, after all, what this country is supposed to be about.
You also had some harsh words for law enforcement in the area. What happened? What failed?
Well, in our estimation, neither local law enforcement nor, to a certain extent, the FBI has put as much energy and resource into this kind of effort as we think ought to be done. I mean, this just simply should not be allowed. It should simply not be allowed to happen in this country, and that's it. End of story. Finished. We would find a way to make it stop if it were on any other issue.
How can you prevent this kind of attack?
There are several different things that have to be done. First of all, I think it's incumbent upon everyone in the community, to join hands and speak up and out and say, we won't have this, not in our town, not in our state, not in our country, period. Don't even think about it. If you commit an act like this, we will bring you to justice immediately and swiftly and surely. So there has to be a social climate, first of all, created that says this is absolutely not acceptable. Secondly, it's as simple as the law enforcement agencies doing their jobs. Thirdly, the people, and as best we understand, this particular physician did pay careful attention to his own personal security, and so there's that element of it too. But I think we just most of all must remember that it's incumbent upon each and every one of us to stand up and speak out and create a social climate, and that includes, if I may say, with my hat on as the Planned Parenthood Action Fund president as well, that we need to be very careful who we're electing to office so that the people who are casting votes are not only supporting a woman's right to choose, but are also making it possible for law enforcement to have the resources to do the job they need to do.
In addition to Gloria Felt, president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, we're also joined by Vicki Breitbart, who is the board member of National Abortion Federation. Apparently, NAF had sent around a warning to doctors in the Buffalo and area and the border and Canada. What was that warning all about? How could you know there was an attack planned for this weekend?
This is not an isolated event. There have been several shootings in the Canadian area and in northern New York over the last few years around this time. November 11th is the Canadian Remembrance Day, and for some reason that's been targeted as the time where abortion providers have been attacked. We had, as I said, attacks in Canada and also one in Rochester. So this is really a pattern. This is not something that's an isolated incident. And so we did send out, National Abortion Federation did send out a warning actually to all of our clinics, just reminding them that this was a time of heightened vigilance. And as Gloria was saying, we could tell that this was a pattern, that this was continuing to happen, and law enforcement should have known this too.
What has been the response of the Amherst Police Department, Amherst being the suburb of Buffalo where Dr. Slepian lived?
I've not been in touch with them directly. I don't have that information. I only have seen really what they've said. I know that they've had law enforcement out there en masse at this point. It's just after the fact.
Well, I think that I heard the police commissioner saying, or read about him saying, that we can't be expected to provide, 24-hour-a-day bodyguards. So what is your response to that?
Well, I think we know that this is a time of year when this is apt to happen, so that I think that we really do deserve that kind of security at this time of year. I think that when Gloria was calling for more elected officials to put more resources into this effort, I think that's what we need to do. And yes, we do expect that they would respond to something like this, to a call for more security.
Think about what happened after the terrorism in Oklahoma City, for example. All stops were pulled out. Everything was done that could possibly be done to bring the perpetrator to justice swiftly and surely. And you just don't always see that. In fact, most of the time you don't see that in these cases where the victim has been an abortion provider.
Well, let me ask something. Under the Bush administration, he was anti-choice, and under Reagan as well, they refused to investigate abortion clinic bombings or the targeting of doctors as a conspiracy. What has happened under the Clinton administration?
Well, the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act is one of the most important things that has happened in recent years that has provided the U.S. Justice Department with considerably more guidance in terms of a policy about these matters. And I think that that policy at the federal level has also helped to inform local law enforcement and get them to pay somewhat closer attention. As a consequence of that, there have been fewer of the mass demonstrations that used to be so disruptive during the Reagan and Bush era. There have been fewer of those kinds of activities, but there have been more of the violent, the assassinations and the violent terrorism that we just saw this last weekend.
You know, it's interesting. Vicki Breitbart was just talking about the number of attacks that have taken place around this time of the year in the upstate New York, Canada area. And I think just the fact that so many people are unaware of this, and especially at this time that it's not being reported before Dr. Slepian was killed, that on November 10th, 1995, physician Hugh Short was shot while watching TV in his home in Ancaster, Ontario. The bullet was fired through a second-floor window and shattered his elbow. On November 12th, 96, physician Jack Feynman shot on the right shoulder by a bullet that came through the back window of his Vancouver home. So 1995, 1996, October 28, 1997, a doctor police did not identify by name was shot in the shoulder while sitting in his home in northern New York. And October 23, 1998, of course, this weekend, physician Barnett Slepian shot and killed in his house in Amherst, New York, bullet fired through the kitchen window. Yet we and the public did not hear about any kind of alerts when we have the same thing every year since 1995.
Well, I think there are other incidents that Vicki Breitbart mentioned that have gone on since 1993, where David Gunn was killed in this country, George Tiller was shot. There were two deaths in the clinics up in Boston. Shannon Lowney and Leanne Nichols were killed. And there are also other events in this country. Emily Lyons was named in the bombing in Birmingham, and there are other incidents in this country that continue to happen. I'm sorry to say there's a long list of ongoing terrorism against abortion providers. And yes, we should certainly have been on more alert this time of year because of the incidents you reported, but I think that this has been going on for even longer time.
Yeah, you need to understand,
Gloria Felt.
We all live like this every day. We live like this every day. We know all these things, and so it may come as a surprise to you, but it certainly doesn't come as a surprise to us. And I think we need to call it what it is. I mean, we need to call it terrorism. We need to understand that that's what it is. We need to for the public to understand that that's what it is, and that what is driving it and underneath it all is an absolute fear of the fact that of what the issue of abortion and reproductive choice is really about. It's really about whether women can have an equal place at life's table. It's really about whether we value children enough to make sure that they can be born wanted and loved and cared for. Excuse me. And so there are extraordinarily profound underlying social issues that I think equally don't get explored. And because of that, these people, these terrorists, are allowed to have much more sway in our society than they should. They aren't just nice people who have a difference of opinion. They are terrorists. They have failed to capture the hearts and minds of Americans. They have failed to outlaw abortion. So they are going to make it absolutely impossible for women to get it in any way they can, including murder.
Gloria Felt, what about this website, ChristianGallery.com?
Well, it's obviously designed to be part of the information flow that enables the terrorists to do their job.
Who is doing it? Who controls this website?
I really don't know the answer to that. I think there is information in the newspapers today. I really am not an expert on it.
So they actually maintain a hit list?
Yes.
You know, I'd like to just add something.
Vicki Breitbart of the National Abortion Federation.
I think that Gloria is absolutely right that we live with this on a daily basis. But I really do want to also say that we all of us continue to provide the service that women need on a daily basis. That in some way this is tried to attempt us from stopping our daily service, and it's not doing that. It's an attempt to try to lessen the number of abortion providers, this is not going to stop us. I think that we really also need to understand that the service, the delivery of service to women and the delivery of the full range of reproductive health care has continued through all of this and will continue through all of this. And we're all also in the process of continuing to train additional abortion providers on a daily basis.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with what Vicki is saying. And I think one of the other unreported stories in this is the enormous moral, philosophical, ethical commitment that we all feel toward making freedom of choice available and accessible to women. And it does have exactly the kind of strength that Vicki said. I know that Vicki was at a training session for new providers just very recently. I find that very heartening. There are many young physicians these days who recognize what's going on and have made it their purpose in life to make sure that women do have a choice in the future.
What about the issue of speech, or do you think that's a false issue that's been raised? I mean, the whole issue of the continuum from those who support any means necessary to end abortion to what we saw this weekend with the killing of Dr. Slepian.
Well, I can't help but think that when people are
Vicki Breitbart.
When abortion providers are labeled as murderers on an ongoing basis, that doesn't escalate the terrorism. I mean, it seems to me that there's a connection here.
Got to call murder for what it is. You got to call terrorism for what it is. Everyone should have freedom of speech. We would be the first to support peaceful picketing and simply making your voices heard in terms of letters to the editor or other kinds of modes of speech. But creating a climate in which hatred festers and out-and-out harassment, vilification, murder, no, that's not free speech.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Gloria Felt, president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, which runs hundreds of women's health clinics around the country, and Vicki Breitbart on the board of the National Abortion Federation. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Amy.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin's our executive producer. Michelle Garcia, our webmeister. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Thank you.